Hey there, spooky friends. It's Megan, and before we hop into the episode, I want to tell y'all a little bit about what we've got coming up in person next. We're so excited to announce that our friends at Little Cottage Brewing have invited us back for a monthly spot with trivia. So that means it's time to mark your calendars with a few dates to come hang out with us and play along. On December 13th, join us for Creepy Holiday Trivia, where we'll have questions ranging from spooky holiday traditions around the world, mischievous holiday mythical beings, holiday-themed horror movies, and more. Then, on January 17th, join us again for a deck themed around fears and phobias. Last but not least on the calendar is February 14th for a theme of romance and scorned lovers in horror. We can't wait to see you on December 13th, January 17th, and February 14th for some excellent craft beer and a scary good time. Okay, I get it. Now, on to the episode.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another week of the Clever Ghouls podcast. We're your bloodthirsty hosts, Marissa,
Blair,
Megan,
and Melissa.
This week, we're going to be discussing Bram Stoker's Dracula, so be prepared for a hellaciously funny episode and some hair-raising riffs on one of my absolute favorite classics. Bram Stoker's Dracula is a dark and twisted tale, and as always, we want to give a heads-up trigger warning for our listeners. Discussions will inevitably include graphic violence, including bloodletting, dismemberment, rape, self-harm, depictions of mental facilities, torture, abduction, and imprisonment, child murder, animal death, and racial slurs.
What a long list.
What a disclaimer.
It's not so great. So go on and head over to doesthedogdie.com for full details and additional content warnings. You guys, Dracula is truly a bat of all trades between the shape-shifting, the gravity-defying, being just super strong and fucking creepy and gross.
And beautiful at times.
Beautiful at times, yeah. Very young and hot. Yeah. And just a host of other badass powers. He's almost unstoppable, or so we think. He's got several weaknesses, and I've wondered if you were Dracula and you were on your way out, describe the situation that would bring about your demise.
My partner is always razzing me about my world-famous balance or lack thereof, which is hilarious because I used to be a gymnast and a dancer, so you'd think that I would have excellent balance, but it turns out once you hit puberty and things go all topsy-turvy, that shit gets thrown out of whack. So I would probably end up doing something stupid that should be easy, like balancing while tying my shoe and falling in a box of wooden stakes, or leaving my coffin open like the tiniest little bit and getting barbecued alive, you know, just
yummy.
Something dumb.
I love that there's just a box of steaks lying around. Yeah. Like,
yeah, you know, just
why not?
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, I would without a doubt die from stepping into a sunbeam trying to pet a cat. I know that's
100%.
I know that's how I would go. I have no question in my mind. That's
it. You would just forget. Like, the cat would just be laying in the sun like cats do. And you're like, oh, that's a very highly petable cat.
Exactly. Look at that cat in that sunbeam. Isn't he so cute? I want to pet him.
It's like, I feel like you'd start to sizzle and then, like, contemplate it for a second and be like, I don't know. It feels worth it. Feels worth the risk.
This is the way I die today.
Worth it.
I love that for you. Of course, anxiety is going to be what takes me out. I'm going to walk past a mirror and be like, something's wrong. I know it. I must check it out. What if there's something in my teeth? What if my hair looks stupid? What if I only did one half of my makeup today and I'm going to like look into a mirror? Does that take out vampires, or I just can't see my reflection? You know what? I'm going to stick with it. For like a brief moment when I wrote this down, I was like, I'm going to combust into flames looking into a mirror. But I forgot. They just don't have a reflection. But it would just drive my anxiety out the roof, and that's what would kill me anyway.
Fair enough.
Megan's going to die because she doesn't know the rules of being a vampire.
Maybe because I'm trying to be cheeky and lead you away from the fact that I am a vampire.
Oh,
mystery.
Intrigue.
Who knows?
Well, I would have no blaze of glory. I would just die engorging myself on all of the garlic bread.
Of course.
Because that is who I am at the core of myself.
It's who you should be.
Oh, this is why we love you.
I think that would be the way I'm going at you guys.
That's fair enough. We are the kind of people who, like, when we run across a recipe that says use one clove of garlic, we use three.
And even you meant then, one it's head, not right? Yeah. You know? One clove, you meant one head? Got it.
Are there any other types of people?
I don't think so.
My mother, who doesn't believe in garlic, maybe a little bit of salt that you can't taste.
They're like apparently irritation for a lot of people's like gastrointestinal tracts.
Allium sensitivity. I do have a friend like that. My mom just thinks it's too spicy.
Oh, is she like, does she think black pepper is
oh, hell spicy? Yeah. She's about as white as they come. I was adopted by the whitest woman to ever exist.
Yeah, that's one of my best friends, Georgia. Yeah. She's like half Filipino, so she's like even brown, but she does not even fuck with black pepper.
How dare.
She's a goddess, though. I know. We'll forgive her this time.
Just this one.
Just this once. One time.
All right. So there are probably about a million different adaptations of Dracula, starting in 1922 with Nosferatu, spanning into present day. But this is the most sexy and primal version to date. Mm-hmm. 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 Just Coppola knows what he's doing. He added so many intricate touches that really speak to the 90s, which, I mean, can we talk about the cast?
Keanu. Peak 90s.
Yummy. Girl Winona.
She just has that kind of face that like makes I just want to shake her and kiss her.
this was the year after Scissorhands, I think, as well, because Scissorhands came out in 91 and then this came out in 92. So Homegirl was like hitting her stride. Yeah,
our spooky queen.
Oh, I just love her.
So, you know, even given that it was very 90s, he really seamlessly fabricates a snapshot of 1897, just with these crazy choices of costume and practical effects and scenery and the little touches from like the vintage cameras that he uses and all of these yummy things. And we could truly wax poetic about all the similarities to the book or differences between other adaptations. But you guys, we only have 2 hours. And we got to get this groove thing going.
We do. For our listeners that might not be as familiar with this adaptation of the movie in particular, can you just give us a synopsis?
Yeah, I want to really, you know, drive into a lot of those themes and then just kind of give you a little bits and pieces of the story along the way. So we start the movie with Vlad Dracula, who is obviously Vlad the Impaler. He's at home with his wife, Elisabetta, when he hears word of the Ottoman Empire coming to shit everything up, just not good. So he decides to nut up, leave his smoking hot wife, and help the cause of the holy war. Amen. So Vlad is unbeatable. He's fucking killing it out there. He's just brutalizing these guys and just winning victory after victory. So as he's on his way home, of course, there's a hater and they decide to send like a fucking eagle or pigeon or whatever the fuck, send word to Elisabetta that he was murdered during the war.
Bum, bum, bum.
And yeah. And of course she goes off the actual deep end and decides to throw herself out of a window into a river.
I mean, defenestration is one of the most dramatic ways to go.
Bruh. So she knows, like, she's never going to see her one true love again. So Dracula comes home, right? He's, like, on cloud nine. He's like, I'm fucking shit up. I'm winning it. We're 10,000 for Jesus, zero for these Ottoman fuckers. And he's completely inconsolable about the death of his wife, you know? Not only is he grieving her death, but the priest decides to be a total dick and remind him that her soul is damned and doomed to hellfire.
Super helpful. Thank you.
The Catholics, am I right?
Yeah. They love their doomsday shit. So, you know, as if he didn't already had a terrible day, you know, the priest just throws that one on him. And since, you know, Dracula wasn't too fond of that, he decides to first say God himself, desecrates the temple, drinks blood from the stone cross, and essentially pledges to be that bitch for all eternity, seeking revenge with the power of darkness.
It feels like a rational reaction to me, to be fair.
I mean, and that's literally just like
like one minor inconvenience, and I too forsake God. So,
you know, he's a thirsty bitch because he sees a cup full of blood, and his first thought is to drink it.
He wants that thing. I don't like. I just like. How mad do you have to be to like stab a rock?
And he stabbed it.
He stabbed it hard.
He did.
I don't know, you guys.
That's like the medieval equivalent of like punching a hole in the wall when you get mad.
It's Vlad's version of punching a hole in the drywall.
Jesus. Yeah. Instead of impaling a human, he just, you know.
Well, that priest should have minded his business, and maybe the rock would have been fine.
We'll hop right back into this episode after a super, super, super quick break.
Hi, everyone. Blair here. I wanted to pop in really quick to let you know that we finally created a Patreon. There are several membership levels for you to choose from if you would like to support the show, and there are exclusive perks for our Patreon supporters to enjoy, like voting on future episodes, access to show scripts and minisodes, and tickets to members-only Q&As and discussions with us, the Clever Ghouls. So what are you waiting for? Visit us at patreon.com/cleverghouls to pledge your support for the show and start enjoying your benefits today.
I mean, there's a lot of things that priests shouldn't be doing and should be doing.
I was about to say, that's like, that goes for every priest throughout history. Just mind your own fucking business.
Yeah, and stay out of trouble.
And don't diddle kids. Like, those are the three things.
Jesus Christ.
We
the
went
bar's
there.
Low, okay? Like
the bar is in hell and still exactly. They can't clear it. Yep. I said what I said.
Speaking of hell, about Christianity.
So that definitely brings us to...
How do we stay out of hell?
You know, and salvation and damnation and good and evil and all of these things.
You know, it's real interesting that Christianity has this whole, like, reputation of... being one of the most forgiving religions, because it's basically just like, believe in Jesus and you're basically forgiven for fucking anything. Like, you could go out and murder a church full of people and ask for forgiveness.
Unless there's a lot of stipulations that follow.
That's the thing, though. Like, on the surface, it's like, it's a very forgiving and loving situation, but it really isn't. There are so many hoops you have to jump through and so many things you have to close your brain off.
Do you believe that Jesus died for your sins and has washed you clean?
Not
and like, but
it,
you know, and like, if you don't really believe that, then they're just like, you're gonna fucking roast it out. So,
because they don't even believe Jesus was brown.
My childhood religious trauma had me second questioning for like my entire childhood whether or not I actually believed in Jesus, and if I didn't. Was I really going to heaven? Because I had some doubts. And
you gotta be a real fucked up person to tell a 4-year-old that they're gonna burn in an eternal lake of fire if they don't welcome some random dude who just decided to die for them into their soul, which
without
they don't have a concept
it.
Of.
You're not allowed to question it.
Don't we tell our children to stay away from strangers?
Yeah.
I don't know. And this is coming from somebody that was like absolutely raised Southern Baptist, like baptized, went to Sunday school, went to Wednesday church, you know.
The religious trauma is real.
Yeah. Hmm. You know, and I think it's really sad too. The whole like, there's a couple things you can't do and there's a couple things you should do. And also if you decide that you don't want to be on this plane of existence anymore and like you're miserable.
It's done.
Nothing you can do. Like you are fucked. And I'm just like, that's so stigmatized. And like to this day, it just, I feel like is so hurtful for people going through shit and that are mentally ill, AKA Absolutely. Me. So,
I mean, all of us have been there, right? Like, I think I'm safe in saying that all of us have been in a place where even if you are afraid of what may happen to you or not happen to you on the other side, we have all been in a place where we would rather not be here. And for someone who comes from a background like that, you suddenly throw yourself into this really dark place of like, I could escape this pain, but then I'll be in more pain. And so it's like pain either way. And then on top of that, having basically sacrificed your entire life and your existence to worshiping this deity who has told you they will have nothing to do with you if you do that. It's just a really twisted form of control, and it primes you to beat yourself down in ways that nobody else really could. You beat yourself down in those moments of weakness and vulnerability.
And I like that he was like, okay, well, you get in trouble for fucking dying this way. I'm never going to die, bitch.
Yeah.
Like,
Dracula chokes was on you.
He was Sagittarius as hell. Like,
we see that a lot in like the thematic elements of this movie too, of like the bastardization and the reclaiming of power of a lot of these things in Christianity. Later I'll talk about representation of this in the costuming choices. But there's a lot of like turning these things on the head, like, for example, the whole suicide thing and how she committed suicide and that was a slight against God. So instead of committing suicide himself, Dracula's like, I will live forever. Like, I'm going to make it to where I can't do that and you can't take that from me. I'm going to do the exact opposite. And there's a lot of dichotomy there between like what would happen from a Christian mindset and what happens instead, that's like the opposite side of the coin. It's really interesting to have evil represented that way. Not that it's like a complete and total opposite, but more like it's this thing, but in a different way.
Yeah, it's really extreme juxtaposition is what it is.
It truly
and we
is.
Get a lot of the extreme juxtaposition in a lot of our characters in here. You know, we see it with Dracula and how he decided to react after his wife booped herself off this planet. We see it with Lucy and Mina, right? Like they're complete different portrayals of each other. You have the wholesome, pure virgin juxtaposed with the promiscuous harlot. And that's a super gross comparison. Number one, why are men, especially Victorian men, so wrapped up with the sexual interactions of women? It's gross.
The virginity, the fragility, it's so disgusting.
It's so gross.
Well, we see it even today in purity culture, right? Like we tell people, especially young people who are blossoming through their puberty and their early adulthood and their late adolescence, when these are things that are supposed to be explored in safe and healthy ways, right? Like we are inherently sexual beings. I would say the only reason any of us is on this earth is to reproduce. Like that's what species do. You know, that's why we have that capability. Everything else is just icing on the cake. From an evolutionary standpoint, that's the only reason we're here. We're here to eat, shit, and fuck. And then die eventually. So it's really interesting to me that this purity culture mindset is even back in the day, right? When people who and
it's even today. You
and to be honest,
about these purity balls and shit.
This, yeah, don't get me started. I have so much experience in purity culture. Like that could be a whole like episode on its own, but. The Victorians, believe it or not, and the Elizabethans too, were actually very sexually open in real life. So to
they were
have
kinky
that,
motherfuckers.
Yeah.
They really were.
They were into it.
They were into frills and fucking, for sure.
Me too.
They truly were. So to have that sort of like this story happening in that time frame, but for everyone to be kind of like prudish in a way, like this whole idea of purity versus promiscuity. It's very 90s, first of all, but especially coming from that Christian lens of this is how women should be and this is how women should not be and see what happens when you are this way. You get turned into a living, dead, blood-sucking vampire lady.
As soon as she's tainted and she's been deflowered, she's now evil all of a sudden. She's been completely devalued.
Yep.
Gross, boo.
And we hate it.
And we also see this whole thing with the contrast between Dracula and Jonathan as well, right? Jonathan is this pure, innocent, naive little cinnamon roll who goes to Transylvania and ends up fucking several ladies and
Getting fucked, let's be honest.
Yeah.
I don't know, that was entirely consensual. Yeah.
He's basically dinner. He's basically dinner. He does get raped. Like let's be real. He does get raped by these people.
Yeah, he do.
And there's nothing consensual about that. Like, he tries to escape several times and is finally successful. But there's a difference between him and Dracula and, like, what happens to them in the end, right? Dracula, the one who uses his physicality, either sexually or brutally, ends up, you know, being disposed of in the end. And Jonathan, who starts out as this really pure, innocent dude, goes through his journey and still comes out on the other side as, like, this pure, innocent dude, right? He doesn't succumb to the way of Dracula. He doesn't become a vampire. He kind of like learns from that and then does his part to get rid of the threat, so to speak, whether or not that threat is Dracula or stuffing down his own preconceived sexuality or whatever it is. And he comes out on the other side getting the girl and living happily ever after with the woman of his dreams. And they both go through this. So we see it in the guys, too. I mean, it's not just the ladies who are going through this. But it is very telling, to me anyway, and very kind of like sex phobic, queer phobic maybe, that those who decide to be anything other than just super pure as the driven snow end up getting yeeted off of this plane of existence.
Yeah. And I plan on digging into how this kind of manifests from some, like, repressed sexual desires later. Like, don't worry. We're going to dig into this. I'm going to psychologist all of y'all later.
Can't wait.
There are definitely a lot of, like, undertones of queer phobia in the movie and in the novel specifically. And just to be, like, that geek who has the copy of the novel on her desk is, like, decor at all times. So the most, like, notable iconic scene in this movie is the one with Jonathan and the brides, for sure. So it's like they're staying in Dracula's castle. Jonathan's approached by the brides. They begin to make their sexual advantages, which a conversation for a different day is one. Why are we conditioned to be like, yeah, Jonathan's got all these ladies on him when it's very clearly a rape scene. But if the roles were reversed, we'd be like, I'm uncomfortable, which we can critically talk about that now. But like back in the 90s, we're like, yeah, man.
Get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's super grody. Kind of virility. Oh, you have a harem of undead bitches.
Women falling
over
at your feet.
You lucky dude.
Lucky dog. Yeah. But so like they draw him into this little silk sheeted love bed, right? And they begin undressing him. Foreplay's building. But before they can penetrate him, literally, because that's what they're doing, right? When fangs, it's phallic as hell. Again, I'm going on a rant about dicks later. Don't worry. But before they get there, an act that would kind of like append the heteronormative behavior, Dracula bursts into the room and starts to like admonish them for their behavior. And in the novel, he says, how dare you touch him? Any of you? How dare you cast eyes on him when I have forbidden it? Back, I tell you, the man belongs to me. That's the big thing, is that's the line there, is that, you know, like the man belongs to me because Dracula wants him. The difference is in the movie version here, this is replaced with an untranslated Romanian dialogue. And even then, Dracula only speaks the first half of it. So it kind of refocuses the film around Dracula and Jonathan's competing feelings for Mina versus any indication that like Dracula might be attracted to Jonathan. So again, we're like putting this back into a cishet normative story. We're erasing any of the queerness that is in Dracula. It's kind of worth noting that Stoker's sexuality has been a point of like a lot of debate over the years. It's super known that he was in a sexless marriage with his wife. He also had an intense adoration, for lack of a better way, with Walt Whitman, Henry Irvine, and Hall Caine. And he even wrote a love letter to Walt Whitman. It's super lovey-dovey and mushy, gay as fuck.
Oh, I bet I would love that.
I'll link it in the show notes for you. So he was also friends with like the very notably an open queer man, Oscar Wilde, who was sentenced to hard labor for like being gay just years before Dracula was released. So there's a lot of speculation that the relationship between Jonathan and the brides and Dracula and all this was based off a lot of like sexual repression and sexual curiosity of like Stoker himself. So just as kind of like some fun gay facts from your fun local gay, I guess, you know.
I will say, just as an aside, around that era of all of these creators who were doing their thing, whether they're painters or writers or what have you, I've been reading a book called The Book of the Dead, which is not as morose as it sounds. It's actually about famous people and like their lives, and it goes into like some of the lesser known facts about them. And so I've been reading about people like, the Barons and Oscar Wilde was one of them. Henry Melville's one of them, Hans Christian Andersen, like all of these people who were like sort of in their heyday around the same time, they were all gay for each other, you guys. Like not even like closeted gay. Like we have documented evidence. Yeah,
not even like the no homo gays, like we were gay.
No, like they were openly gay for each other and had no problem expressing that. Like Hans Christian Andersen even showed up at people's doors and would stay with them for like weeks on end, just hanging out with them and enjoying their company.
He sounds like a 100% a lesbian, and I can say that. Been there, done that. But yeah that's like, ooh, wants to move.
He would just invite himself in and just hang out for weeks on end.
Love
so
that for him.
This whole like exploration through Dracula, the story Dracula of like this whole queerness thing is not out of character.
Yeah,
it's not
at
us
all.
Reading too deep into something that isn't there. It's absolutely there, and it's there on purpose.
Oh yeah, it's super there. It manifested a lot in the art of the time, and you know, Stoker was not subtle about his sexuality at all. A lot of the literary artistical geniuses of this time were not particularly subtle, but it was still taboo to be anything that was not heteronormative at the time. So it's still really interesting to kind of look back and see this. It's also kind of neat to view this movie and reframe it when you look at what's going on in queer culture at the time that the movie came out, because we're at the height of the AIDS pandemic right now as well. So there is a lot of the queerness of this movie was removed. And there's some really cool interviews from the director who said like he did remove it on purpose for fear of demonizing like gay people further, because AIDS and bloodborne diseases and blood sucking queer people is like, feels weird right now. So let's maybe let's take the gay out of the movie for now. So,
and that sucks because that's inherently like evil. No, it's just like going back to like the good versus evil.
Yeah, that's okay. I was just going to say this is a very common thing that we see. In this time period that the movie was produced in, so the early 90s, but also in vampire culture in general in around this time period, because you have to remember as well, the Interview with the Vampire came out around this time, and it is very clearly a
also
queer,
a yummy movie.
Very queer movie.
And they just made the new one that is actually gay, which I love.
Yes. So the original source material is gay. Like, I don't know if y'all have read any of Anne Rice, but she is famous.
I have a tangent in the outline later about how vampires are
gay.
are a huge part of gay. I mean, but truly a huge part of gay culture and the Victorian vampires, how they kind of like served as the battering ram on the front lines for queer culture. I have a lot of psych tangents for y'all today, so buckle up.
Love that. Well, it's funny. It's because when we think of gay stuff, like we love our rainbows and our glitter and stuff, but like we also love some vampire gay too. So
it's dark and sexy.
Anything with the drama. We're just, you know, dramatic. But yeah, I could be reading way too far into this, but I really enjoy the fact that almost everything that I have ever encountered as far as the queer community in general, that starts out as something to hurt people in the queer community,
yeah, we
either
reclaim
representing
it.
Them, you reclaim it and then you make it better, which is just so powerful. Like, you know, there's nothing
Can't
that's more
down.
Open than saying, hey, you know, gay people are demons. They're bloodsuckers.
Yeah,
they're going
we
to
are.
Murder you in your sleep. It's
Kinky.
Like, yeah, and we're sexy. And we have fabulous fashion sense.
Yeah, sexy as hell.
I love that whole energy. Like, and now everyone wants to be that. Everyone wants that intrigue and that mystery surrounding them because it's sexy and it's hot and it's interesting. I don't know. I just like it. It's cool.
Yeah. I just think it's neat.
I just think it's neat.
Be gay and do crimes, y'all.
Blair just likes badass, powerful people is all.
I do. I just love people who, like, don't take shit from people, especially people who have historically been oppressed. Like, don't take shit from these fucking colonizers. Don't let them do it.
All right. So we love discussing just like the classic good and evil. And now we are going to basically seg back to the story. So we're in modern England and we meet Jonathan and his soon-to-be wife, Mina, who, strangely enough, looks a lot like Elisabetta, Dracula's, unfortunately, dead wife. So Jonathan finds out from work that one of his coworkers has ended up in a mental institution and that his account that he's been working for needs maintenance. So the account is in Transylvania and, you know, Jonathan's in the UK and he's about to get married and wants to really make moves for his career and decides this is going to be awesome. This is going to be an adventure. Let's go ahead and trek off to meet this count and make all this money and fuck shit up.
As Jonathan, you as- fucking dumbass. Mm-hmm. Y'all, I hate Jonathan so much.
Jonathan is pretty dumb. So with that being said, I wanted to really dig into kind of the theme of intuition and red flags and manipulation and how there are some things that this dumbass should have probably really taken a closer look-see at.
He should have, but Jonathan is a waste of space. Fucking Victorian dandy, and he doesn't know how to use his gut or his intuition or look at anything closely, and I hate him. That's all I have to contribute.
He rides through this castle. There is a circle of fucking blue flames that he's riding through, but he's just like, what is happening? And the Romanov people he was sharing a carriage with, they were just like, oh fuck, like you're gonna need this little trinket and this thing, like God be with you, because you're probably not going to get out of there. And
you're going to have a bad time.
It's not going to be a good time. Like, they literally throw his ass out of the carriage and they're like,
deuces. As they should.
They did not even come to a complete stop.
No.
Tuck and roll, bitch.
They were like, we got to get the fuck out of here. And so he ends up in this castle, meets this boob-headed, scary, skin falling off, pale, greasy motherfucker. And
hairy palms. Literal hairy palms.
It's distracting to say the least. And
that's from all the masturbation.
Exactly. That's what I was like, that's gotta be a
problem. You know? And so I'm just thinking to myself, like, y'all, when I go into a place and like they don't ask me if I want a glass of water, I'm like out of there. Like I'm just like, okay, like
this time to go.
This castle is fucking weird. And
usually my go-to mantra is, oh, to have the confidence of a mediocre white man. But this is the kind of confidence that gets you killed.
Yeah.
This is privilege that you've never stepped foot into anything dangerous whatsoever because of your status and privilege in society. And so you just cannot even fathom something bad happening to you.
Good for you, Jonathan, you fucking dumbass.
But it's so like, it's almost like homoerotic too, going back to that with as far as like, I don't actually know if that term is okay to say anymore.
Okay.
Honestly, I love it, so.
Yeah.
The gays like, have spoken, you're fine.
Okay, thank you. But like, there's, like you were saying, Marissa, there's so many weird, like red flags. Like so many. Not even just the blue flame and the Romanese being like, okay, good luck, motherfucker. But also he gets inside and like Dracula's making all of these funny jokes. I don't drink wine. Like, it's fun. And I love it too because like so much of the costuming, I also love What We Do in the Shadows. And so, oh, yeah, like, so you can tell where the inspiration came from.
Yes.
And like his fucking like shadow. And you can see like him looking at the shadow like this isn't adding up. And it's like, why are you staring at a picture of my wife? Why are you trying to shave me?
They talk about homoerotic. I was exactly, like, this man.
Exactly. That was like, I just feel like, I don't know. There was a better way to do that.
If he was younger and hotter, I'd totally be on board with that. You ever shave somebody's
if he were like regular,
face, it's
if he
hot.
Was regular Gary Oldman with regular Keanu Reeves, I'd be... That's fine.
All day.
I got no problems.
You know, just as an aside, all of those like jokes that he was making, you know, like just the tone and the general vibe reminded me of every time I've ever been in church and an older man of the church walks up to me and is like, give me a hug. And like you would be expected to hug them because that's the polite thing to do. Mm-mm. Like it's
I have bodily autonomy, you fuckers. Like, don't touch me.
Well, when you're 5 and 6 years old and you've never known anything else,
then being
the
polite.
Only thing you can really trust is your elders, in my case, it was my grandparents, who were taking me to church every Sunday. And I was taught that not making a scene
and respecting just your
doing
elders
the hug was the most
never,
polite and respectful yeah. thing to do.
Never
and that robbed me
elders.
Of my bodily autonomy from a very young age. And that's what's happening mm-hmm. here. He is being robbed of his bodily autonomy by those advances, even though Dracula hasn't even touched him yet.
Yeah.
Because he's expected
it's
to
that
be
manipulation.
Polite.
Exactly.
It's that manipulation.
And that, I think, goes so full force into, like, let's talk about Renfield. Yeah, Renfield.
Tom
and
Waits.
Like,
just call him Tom Waits.
Tom Waits.
Tom Waits.
AKA Talking Tomato. This homeboy is like, I mean, you know, they flash over to the mental institution and, like, I won't even go into just how terrible and fucked up that was back in the day and just even nowadays, but just complete devotion, complete manipulation and just, like, my master's coming. I must wait for him.
Yeah,
like,
he is at his feet.
He mm-hmm. is, like, number one cuck for Dracula. And I think that character is so important, you know, as we go on into the story to, like, reference to, because everybody is thinking that they're getting, like, gaslit and, like, they're crazy. This can't be true. This is so otherworldly. Like, they're vampires? What? And he has been able to manipulate people in so many different ways and, like, get into their psyches and their brains. And I think it's good to know that, like, yeah, this actually happened to somebody. And, I mean, Dracula's been alive for fucking ever. So, like, how many times has, like, how many of these people has he manipulated and, like, made go crazy? And
I mean, arguably a lot, considering A, the fact that he's Vlad the Impaler, and B, the fact that he has existed for so long.
Forever. Yeah.
Like, we don't really understand, like, how long he can go in between feedings, I guess. But obviously, if the Romanis, who are the locals, understand that there's something not legit about this, it's pretty clear that he's murdered a bunch of people.
That's why he's so crusty. He's so old. God.
I just want to hand him a pair of nail clippers through this whole movie.
Nail clippers, yes. Moisturizer, ooh, just anything.
Yeah.
Do they make SPF Infinity?
No, he actually needs some sun. Bless his heart. Like,
but
he'll
he
never
can.
Say that.
Or he'll just Chris.
He can yeah. just
he
like
can.
And no, because like they were
indirect sun.
Indirect sun.
Okay,
I don't
okay.
know. Like umbrella.
Haven't you bitches seen Twilight?
That's why he was.
I
wearing
have not
sunglasses.
Seen Twilight.
That's why he was wearing sunglasses. Yeah. But it's crazy. Not only the mental manipulation, but the physical manipulation of Dracula to do his bidding. I mean, he's able to control the weather. He is just doing his freaky werewolf creature, which was just on some next level shit. I will never forget watching this movie for the first time and, like, really being disturbed by that. You know, turning into, like, frogs and being, like, a rat person in the coat, which, like, wish I could do and I think would be a great party trick. Bats, you know, creatures of the night, just all of that.
The man can set the mood, truly.
Well, and if a guy tamed a wolf, I mean, that's a love language for me.
Yeah.
Like, Melissa's like, there's nothing sexier than this.
I mean,
Melissa would be the
Do you want
first
me to tell
to
James
go.
That that's what you want for Christmas? Is for him
oh,
to,
he knows.
To tame a
oh,
wolf
knows.
For you?
He okay. knows. He knows exactly what I need. But like,
I love that.
Yeah, the guy's like creepy, 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 and then he's like petting the wolf that's escaped, which just walks between his bars out of his zoo cage, which is hilarious. And then he's just like terrorizing London, and then he just happens into where Vlad is, and Vlad and Mina are like, "Oh no, a wolf!" And Vlad just like tames it, and Mina's like, oh, he's so soft.
This is after they went on their whole little like absinthe trip, which I thought was, I was just like, can you imagine being on some like weird psychedelic shit and then seeing a wolf in front of you and like being terrified? And then you're like, oh, but I want to pet it. And then
that's me sober.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then he was like, he likes you. He likes
I mean, classic gaslighting though, right? Like putting her in a position where she's questioning her own reality and whether or not she can trust her brain in that moment. Mm. Like, he's gaslighting her.
Yeah.
That is textbook gaslighting.
Gaslighting with magic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And weird booze that, like, everybody back then, all of, like, the queerest and the hottest and the smartest people, they were all just like, let's go to the cafe and have, like, an absinthe and, like, make some paintings and stuff and then have an orgy.
You were real hardcore. You would do your opium and your absinthe at the same time.
Yeah. Mm. That sounds like a great Saturday.
All of the vices.
All right. So Jonathan, you know, unfortunately becomes a human popsicle for Dracula's brides. And, you know, we got a little ahead of ourselves, but yes, Dracula decides to pack up a bunch of his Transylvania dirt and, you know, he sails over to, you know, because what do you need when you're traveling? I need 18 cases of dirt with me.
Is that not what you pack when you go on vacation? Is that weird that I do that?
I do sacks of skincare.
Don't let the maids vacuum under the bed because then you'll have to send Guillermo back to your home country and get you some more dirt.
Transylvania Dirt is like the next name of my band, I swear. I play
that's
no instruments.
That's the name of my ska band.
Yeah, Transylvania Dirt.
So... So he brings all his fucking dirt and he gets on this ship. And mind you, the ship like ends up at the port and everybody's like, where is all of the sailors? What has happened? Where's the captain? So he had a couple snacks along the way. He was really, you know, stocking up.
Traveling makes you hungry.
It
you
does.
Need road trip snacks.
You do. You
they
do.
They didn't have a 7-Eleven there. You can't blame him. Like, how is he couldn't get Funyuns and gummy worms? Like,
no.
He had to eat a sailor. God.
Bonus points because they've been brined for God knows how long in that salt here. Like,
nice and tasty.
Yeah.
So, obviously, you know, after he's fed, he, like, gets off that ship looking fucking hot and tasty. No longer does he have the hairy palms and the long nails. He just, like, looks dandy as hell. He's, like, sexy, young, never looks better. And you know,
that happened to me after I eat a bunch of food, all I get is bloated and sleepy.
Sleepy, yeah.
So he's looking sexy and he's like, okay, I'm at like the top of my game. He's like, I've got that dumbass Jonathan back home. Like, you know, he's gone for, and I'm going to go and try and rekindle this long lost love affair with this complete stranger. So
as one does,
you know, just weird people, mostly men, but anyways,
so it's not wrong.
So no. We go on to meet a host of just very important characters, including Lucy, who we've talked about, one of Mina's closest friends. And the story comes to an epic climax as we see just how far Dracula is willing to go to get what he wants. So going into that, Blair, tell me about some of this dumb feminine virtue and sexuality shit. I want it all. Tell me about it.
Well, I mean, it should go without saying that feminine virtue goes hand in hand with feminine purity, and the less purity you have, the less virtuous you have, which is just completely fucking stupid. Yeah, I think we are all in disagreement with that particular dogma.
I'm usually in disagreement with men.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, patriarchy is weird. But we do have two, like, extremes as far as, like, femininity represented, right? We have Mina, who is the docile, quiet, meek, you know, only speaks when spoken to. She wears very modest clothing, usually high neck. She usually has her hair done, which back in the day, you know, you always did your hair if you were going to be in any company other than your own. That's just how it was done. And you also had like 3 or 4 different layers of undergarments and then 3 or 4 different layers of petticoats. And
oh, talk about sweaty crotch. Just
actually,
yep.
Back in the day, bloomers, which is what you would, or drawers is what they were called.
They're kind of breathable, aren't they?
Sometimes called combinations as well, but because you had so many skirts and things, your petticoats, your linings, your overskirts, your pockets, and then your overskirts over your pockets and all that stuff, your drawers would actually be crotchless.
Oh.
Because you could not go to the
You couldn't go to the bathroom.
Room.
So no swamp crotch.
So no swamp crotch. Very breathable.
Well, that's kind of kinky still.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. totally in line with the Victorian eras. They're just fronting as prudes, but really, you're all a bunch of sluts.
They were some kinky bitches.
Hell yeah.
Very kinky. Yeah.
I'm here for it.
And then on the other side of the coin, we have Lucy, who is represented with a much more vibrant color palette in her dress and in her just natural coloring. She has red hair and red lips and just like stands out, you know. She also tends to show a lot of skin in her wardrobe choice, which is in stark contrast to Mina. And she... It's interesting, the first time we ever see her, you think she's in a white gown, which is supposed to be like representative of her purity. But when you start looking really closely at it, it's actually a lot of pink underneath, which just suggests, you know.
She's flirty. She's sexy.
Right. There's also a lot of social differences here because Mina is obviously a teacher. She's what we would consider to be lower middle class, whereas Lucy is very much a high class bitch.
Yeah.
She has several suitors after her. She basically has her pick of the litter.
She's living her best life.
Yeah. Which is why she gets away with these low fronts and low backs and off shoulders. And she wears her hair down and she wears all these crazy ass colors. And
yeah. And that's how like we're introduced to her, right? Like the setting is literally where she's the object of desire for three different men. Not one, not two, but three. So we start out with Dr. John Seward and then the cowboy Quincy, who is just, ooh, yummy. And even dumb, you know, very dumb, but yummy. And then the man that she eventually becomes betrothed to, Arthur Holmwood, who is a dipshit. And
correct.
Yeah. I do love some Carrie Elwes, though.
Yeah.
Does he have the most money? That's all that really matters here. Yeah. I mean, at this point in history, I would argue up until 1973, when ladies were able to hold property and have their own bank accounts, marriage was a transaction. You came with a dowry, and you were basically property handed off from your father to your new spouse. And it really depended a lot on how much money your spouse had as to whether or not you could afford to maintain the life or move up in social status from where you were.
Boo, so she says for the 14th time.
I know. It's uncomfy.
And Lucy was just like a rich, flirty little bitch. Like she just was trying to live her best life. And, you know, she meets her fate, like, because it's almost like she's chosen. I mean, obviously Dracula is, you know, I think trying to hurt Mina, but
yeah,
also continuing to manipulate her through Lucy. But like she meets her fate and it's almost like she is being punished for her feminine wiles.
Well, and it's a lot of taking away any obstacles of Mina's affection as well, right? Like, yep. We start out with Jonathan, who she's betrothed to, and then we move on to her not-so-subtle lesbian lover, Lucy, and take her out of the picture. So who's left? Does Mina even have parents who are living? Like, what kind of support structure does she have? If you're completely alienated from everyone who loves you and cares for you, you are very easily manipulated, especially as a woman with no access to anything.
Yeah, but it's telling that Dracula goes for, in this context, with the way it's written, you know, it's like Lucy is the one that ultimately meets demise versus like Mina being the one that would have like an ill fate waiting for her. Lucy becomes a monster because of her sexual awakening and her impurity, because it's a danger to the world, you know, a world where men are the one that are in control here. The commentary is definitely meant as like a warning to the dangers of growing female power in society, and it's a threat to the established patriarchy. And Stoker uses the same language throughout Dracula to talk about the dangers of sexuality, especially the sexuality of women. And whenever women are strong and sexual, they're described as, you know, voluptuous and languorous. And it's usually always in like some sort of dangerous context. Boo, she says again.
And, you know, and to go back to that scene of, you know, when he like full on turns into a scary wolf creature and then ultimately,
they do it.
Yeah, no, well, he rapes her.
He rapes her. Yeah.
He bewitches her and rapes her. And it is just,
he basically slips her a magic roofie and rapes her.
And like, and she is just left like outside in the rain. Mina goes after her and it's just like, she has no idea what's happened, and she just keeps, you know, saying like, oh my god, those terrible red eyes, and I feel like something's horrible's happened, it feels like my soul has been taken away. And it's just like, I have never felt fatter for a bitch in my life, man. Like, it is, it's like truly, and like, and then, you know, Mina has no idea what the hell's going on. Lucy has no idea what the hell is going on. And like, fucking Dracula, while he's like whining and dining Mina, he's doing these horrific deeds to Lucy. And it's just crazy to see the difference between like being sensual, being gentle, here, pet my wolf friend, and like, you know, and then being like absolutely brutal and terrifying. And it's just,
well, one of those women hold value to him and the other one doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of them's a washed up harlot and the other one is still virginal and pure and untouched and holds inherently more value in this time.
Because she reminds him of his dead wife.
But also, yeah, it reminds him of his dead wife, except she's now a young, hotter, virginal version of his dead wife.
Ugh. And he one uses is a challenge, her hotter is best one is friend not.
As a pawn because she's worthless to him because she's a whore.
And that's how deep it goes, because like I found myself wondering in this movie, like, wait, is she actually like Elisabetha reincarnated? Because she's like, I remember you, blah, 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 blah. And then I'm like, wait, but he could literally just make her think that.
Yeah.
He could literally just make her think that. And I don't know what's true anymore. I don't actually know what's real.
Neither does Mina.
That's the point, is that we're questioning the whole time, right? From the time he sees her picture until the time he actually meets her in person, we're sitting there questioning, like, is she that bitch? Like,
yeah.
And then she's like, oh, I feel pretty terrible because I think I love him, but also I'm supposed to be getting married to Jonathan and all, like, so it's just like a whole mind fuck, the whole movie. Yeah. And I think that's very part of the situation and what kind of keeps you guessing about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've all been there too. We've all been the object of someone who knows exactly what to say, exactly when to say it, exactly how to coerce us into doing what they want us to do. And it's not because that they love us, not because that they're interested in us. It's truly just because we have something that they want. And the more challenging it is, it seems, the more fun it is for people like that.
It's power. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just a grab for power and control.
Gross. Anywho, so going into, you know, Mina and, you know, the green, the costume and the fertility even, I want to hear everything about the costumes. Just take it.
I'm so excited.
Take it away.
Everybody pause the podcast, refresh your coffee, and come back and listen to Blair wax poetic about costuming for the next, I don't know, 6 hours. We have time.
Yeah. I have a lot to say about these costumes. I have so much to say. I was only going to say a little bit, but the more I thought about it, the more I was like,
you know,
like,
we want you to
so
say
much.
A lot.
All of it.
It's too much. So I'm going to try and go quickly, but there's a lot. First things first, Coppola did not get the budget that he wanted for this movie, right? Like, he wanted like 3 or 4 times over what he was awarded by the studio. And so he famously said, the costumes will be the set, which you love to see it. Not only because, obviously, beautiful clothes that can live in museums forever and ever, but also it helps the actors in such a way that sets just can't. There is something so magical when you put something on and you become this character. It's just amazing. So another thing about the costumes is that they were designed by Eiko Ishioka. She's no longer with us, unfortunately, but she won an Academy Award for her work on this movie. She also designed the costumes for my favorite Cirque du Soleil show, Varikai,
which is loosely based
around the myth of Icarus. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. But yeah, so she designed the costumes for the Cirque du Soleil show, Varikai, which is based loosely around Icarus and Daedalus, except instead of Icarus like plunging into the ocean, he basically plunges into like this new land that's just full of all these amazing plants and animals and things, and he gets kind of like a redemption. Ooh. It's really cool. Go watch it. Another thing about these costumes is that they're not period accurate. They're actually about 10 years behind where they're supposed to be. So the movie takes place in the 1890s, but the silhouettes are more like 1880s, which is really interesting, but it actually adds a lot more drama because by the time we made it to the 1890s and even into the 1900s, these silhouettes are starting to get smaller because we're headed into what we will eventually know as World War I. So fabric was starting to get a little more scarce. So we were having to use less fabric to try and maintain the same silhouettes. The more rich you were, the more fabric you could use. So obviously the bigger the dress, the more rich you were. Which is why we also start to see like shorter skirts, scandalous. Fewer underskirts, also scandalous. And women really stop wearing a lot of like the hoops and the bustles and things like that.
But then they put crotches back in underwear and I feel like that was really the wrong choice.
You know, pros and cons.
One step forward, two steps back.
You know, it truly is. It truly is a man's world. That sucks. That sucks a lot. But yeah, starting with Dracula, he has some really cool costume choices. His armor is meant to resemble a flayed human. It's supposed to harken back to like the story of Vlad the Impaler and how he just fucking flailed people and put their heads on spikes and the rest of their bodies on other spikes, and he's a pretty bloody dude. His helmet is actually a wolf's head. It's got the pointy ears and everything, and that foreshadows him turning into a wolf.
That armor is my favorite costume of his.
It's so good.
Isn't it cool?
Kind of like sexy and queer. Yeah. Yes.
BDSM. Yeah.
No, it kind of makes me horny, and I like it.
I definitely thought it was a bat, though.
That's totally intentional.
I definitely thought his helmet was a bat. Mm.
Yeah. A bat?
I did not even think of the wolf. Yeah.
Well, makes sense. They're same-ish kind of family. I mean, bats are, I think, part of the vulpine. Like, they're very closely related to foxes, bats are. I think they're, like, one genus over or something like that. But anyway, you look at a bat, and they're basically sky puppies. Foxes are basically forest puppies. Wolves are
everything's
puppies.
A puppy.
You know, they're all the same. One of the
they're all puppies, and they all have ears that I want to pet.
Nibble, nibble.
My God.
So true.
But I digress.
Dracula also has a lot of Chinese influence in a lot of his costumes. For example, his giant silk kimono that's gold has dragons on it. And that is a lot of Ishioka's background coming
Very
into this.
Cool.
This is the first like big movie that she worked on, and the bitch won an award for it. We love an iconic queen. He's always in really warm colors too, which, you know, depending on how far you want to read into it, could be indicative of the fires of hell, eternal damnation, etc., etc. You see him in a lot of gold and red. Even the blacks, like the shades of black that he tends to wear, are on the warmer side of black instead of like a cool black or a cool gray. Super interesting, very intricate ideas going into a lot of his
maybe
pieces.
He's just a summer.
Mia, maybe he is. You know, maybe he is. In contrast, Mina is always seen wearing green, except for a few instances that I'll go into in a minute. The green is supposed to signify youth, vitality, and newness.
And because she's all fertile and virginal.
Ew.
She's just so innocent, you know. Her costumes also frequently feature a leaf motif or a nature motif. And once you see them, you can't unsee them. They are on every single costume that she wears. Lucy's styling is meant to infer that although she is supposed to be pure and naive like Mina, she is actually full of joie de vivre and has no problem exploring and experiencing the world with abandon. Her white dress, as I said earlier, that we first see her in, actually is very light shades of pink, and then it kind of gets deeper the further in the costume you go. It's off the shoulder. It's super, like, risque for the time period. Mina is always, of course, in a high collar with high hair and all that stuff. Later on, earlier when I talked about the bastardization of a lot of the pure things that are happening and how they kind of get twisted into something that's not so pure. So Lucy actually ends up in a green dress, but it's off the shoulder, it's got a low front, it's got a low back, and it is wrapped with embroidered snakes, which is really
interesting. I love that dress.
I mean, when we think about like the mythology of snakes and like how they're represented in juxtaposition with the feminine, we think about Medusa and how her myth went the way that it did, and Adam and Eve is supposed to represent the fall of the virtue of women. So this is right before Lucy gets raped and essentially murdered, right? And then later on, when Lucy is in her wedding / burial dress, she is actually meant to be reminiscent of an Australian frilled lizard, which is why we see that huge Elizabethan frill on her. It's also supposed to visually separate her head from the rest of her body, because obviously that's how you
that makes sense
get rid of a vampire.
Oh man,
very off with her head.
I was wondering about it because it seemed kind of out of place almost. Like,
yeah, it's supposed to be over the top, it's supposed to be wild. The dress itself, like, just out of context of the movie, just standing by itself in the museum. Absolutely jaw-dropping. The embroidery alone had to have taken weeks, if not months, to do. Ishioka said, although she is buried in a wedding dress, it does not belong to any style because Lucy turns into a vampire wearing this dress. I wanted to make sure it would look bizarre and haunting after the transformation. So it's meant to separate her even further from her humanity. This is like the genesis of her transformation. Mm. By now she's already been, like, she's already had her encounter with Dracula. So this is what we, when we start really seeing her physical transformation, And then she ends up in this like red chemise kind of nightgown thing. It doesn't really make sense from a practical standpoint, because when you talk about corsets, bustiers, stays, etc., they usually are over a smock or some kind of thing underneath to keep your skin from chafing. But obviously she's not wearing anything underneath her stays, and she's wearing this weird little cape thing. Doesn't make any practical sense, but it's red.
Red because it's both sexy and evil, just like women, right?
Right. And the only other person that we've seen wearing red up to this point is Dracula. And maybe the vampire sisters. I don't recall if they were wearing red. Needless to say, we don't see any, like, heroes of the story wearing red or any, like, loud colors. It's always these immortal beings, right? So when Mina departs from her green / mint color palette, she's in her iconic, amazing red dress. This dress is unbelievable. It has a low back. It has a low front. It has 3/4 length sleeves that are also slit so at good. The elbows. So they kind of like wing out. They're beautiful. They also have the leaves, right? So they come around the collar, they come around the edge of the back, they kind of like snake around her body, and it's meant to sort of come across as vines because she's ensnared in Dracula's sort of trap at this point. So that's a visual representation of her like being all tangled up in this whole situation.
He got her all up in his web.
And then the last palette, oh man, no way out either. Like it is like all over. And then she does a final palette shift into this sort of like deep olivey green with a striped shirt underneath. So it's kind of like a vest with a not as high of a collar as we're used to with her, but definitely still like a mock turtleneck, almost like a mandarin collar with a striped shirt underneath. And that is like her basically saying, I've decided to go to the dark side. Like, this
love
is happening.
For her.
Right. The last little bit that I want to mention about the costumes is Elisabetta's dress. So we only see Elisabetta for like 30 seconds in the movie, but she's wearing this Renaissance-y green dress. It's several different shades of green. It's got the leaves in gold brocade all the way down the skirt, but emblazoned across the chest is Dracula's dragon. So it's a visual sort of motif of like, this is the bridge between Dracula and Mina, because we have the leaves and the green, and then we have the gold dragon, and they come together into this one costume. If you want to learn more about the costumes of this movie, there are tons of articles and documentaries and studies, and gosh, we could just go on forever. But the two that I use to like compile all this information in addition to my own noggin is the documentary The Costumes Are the Sets and the podcast The Art of Costume. I will put both of those links in the show notes for you guys if you want a deeper dive.
I am personally offended, however, that you did not once mention Renfield's finger harnesses or his Dr. Seuss-esque HVAC straight jacket thing. Why was this not discussed?
I mean, I felt like those spoke for themselves. There's the, you know, I mean, straight jackets are sexy.
That man looked like it was doodled on
him. What
else can
be
said? It didn't even look like real clothing. It looked like something out of a Dr. Seuss cartoon. And they were like, but hear me out here. What if we put finger harnesses with it? And somebody was like, sold. Sign us the fuck up.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many instances in this movie of just bondage motifs, BDSM. It goes there. It really does. I mean, you can even look into the sorts of like belts and buckles that you see on Dracula, and
but it's whimsical too. I mean, like the sunglasses he's wearing.
That man is whimsy.
What are those?
Weird whimsy.
It's completely beautiful and completely bizarre in its beauty, and the way that she hit that sort of like middle ground. Like I said, entire theses could be written about the costumes of this movie and we still wouldn't cover it all.
So good.
So we already touched base on the vampire sisters, going back to kind of the whole feminine virtue and essentially succubi. They're overpowering. They are using their sexual desire and then literally draining his life force and his blood. And it's a sad portrayal because
they're a plot device to show that femininity and autonomy of your sexuality within women is kind of inherently an evil thing, right? Like, the brides specifically are painted as these uncontrollable savages that are just forcing men to do their bidding and utilizing their femininity to destroy them. And I love them.
Yeah.
That's it's interesting it. How like, kind of going along that theme, they're used, like, the fact that they consume children as opposed to creating
having them?
Children. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Melissa.
Yeah.
Oh, is that a good one?
That's a yeah. good Bum. One.
In the podcast, there's nothing smart that's going to be said after that.
Yeah. Mic drop.
That's it, everybody. It's been great talking to you. There's no more episodes.
Bye-bye now.
I'm kidding. Come back. We love you.
I want to hear about some phallic shit.
You're trying to listen to my tangent about dicks?
I'm trying to hear about some dicks.
I am ready to talk to you about some sexual and phallic imagery of vampires. So vampires are phallic as fuck. We come down to something as small and simple as their fangs. Their fangs are phallic, all the way down to the fact that they're used to penetrate things. Like, it is a phallic-shaped thing that we're penetrating people with. The stake through a heart, also phallic as fuck, with more penetration. Then we go through and there's a lot of, you know, with the blood, it's a lot of squirting and bodily fluids.
This is proof that no one chooses their sexuality, because who would choose that? Who would just outwardly choose that?
Yeah, that's always my joke, that sexuality can't be a choice, because why would I willingly be attracted to men? But yeah, I mean, vampires literally just walking around with a mouthful of dicks penetrating things, and their ultimate demise is further penetration with phallic items. There really isn't a long rant here. I just wanted to be like, there's a lot of dick-shaped things, right? It's very dickish.
Well, and going back to our earlier point about the queer community, like, taking back things that are meant to oppress and hurt them, like, there's nothing more powerful, I think, than being like, I'm gonna fuck your mom. Yeah, well, I fucked her yesterday, or something like that, you know? Like, not the incesty part, but you know what I'm talking about, like, just like, you know, you're supposed to be this demon yeah. person who's penetrating people against their will, and it's like, joke's on you. People like this. Like, a lot.
But also, like, Lucy's staking especially is super sexually graphic and phallic, right? Like, it is loaded with sexuality, and it's like mm-hmm. a perverse reimagining of, like, your wedding night kind of thing. Bleh is the only sound that I have to go for it. But it's just like Holmwood, which, first of all, it's even a phallic name, right? Like, I know that this is just supposed to be a name that means, like, you live next to a cherry tree or some shit, but I'm going to make a wood joke and you can't stop me because I'm 13. But in that one, it's like his undead bride, like, shakes and contorts and all of this. Like, it's super sexual. And again, it's just super icky. Yeah, she's like in a quasi-orgasmic state over this. It's echoing like a loss of virginity again, which, as a reminder to our viewers, virginity is made up. It's a social construct and it's not a thing you can lose.
Speaking of Lucy, so I want to really go into kind of like the supernatural and just how absolutely fucking bizarre this is, like, juxtaposed with like the whole science part of this. So during the movie, we are introduced to the two doctors who are just like pioneers for scientific method and continued education. And like, we literally meet, you know, Anthony Hopkins while he's in a little dark room seminar with a bunch of people going over some like science shit about bats or what the fuck ever. So Dr. John Seward finally caves because he's been trying to heal Lucy after she's going through all of this shit, and he's stumped. There's nothing is working, and he brings in Van Helsing. And can we just talk about how amazing and fucking hilarious and, like, to the point, Anthony Hopkins, like, brilliant him. Choice of casting.
I love him so
he's
much.
He's hilarious.
He's just the best. My favorite part was, yes, let's save your fiance, but God, I'm so hungry.
It's relatable content, right?
That is putting yourself first. And I love
it. We that. Have to do that.
Absolutely.
He can't pour from an empty cup, Melissa.
Yeah. And I mean, it really is interesting how, like, going into, like, the supernatural and how it does kind of overcome these men of science, right? And so, you know, at first I was like, really, I think even when I wrote this, I was like, oh God, I'm so bothered by these guys. Like, she's like, got a brain fever or a brain worm, whatever the fuck they know for all they care. And they're still like trying to get with her. And then it's like, well, but there's that kind of manipulation tactic where is that totally consensual on their side? Like, are they being drawn? Are they being manipulated? I don't know how to feel about that. It feels super problematic to me. I'm like kind of stumped, doing a confused little head tilt about that. Which also, I kind of love it. I kind of love that we're in that situation and it's not just like, oh, you know, please, before I die, please be with me, blah, 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 blah. No, it's like, it's a gray area and it's weird. Like, who's being taken advantage of here? So don't fuck someone with brain worms, man.
Or don't just try to save someone just because you want to fuck them. It's the same thing with men only wanting to be friends or respecting women because they want to fuck them. And like, poor Lucy. She's just like the object of all of these men's desires. Everybody still's trying to bang and like she's literally losing her humanity.
Exactly. She didn't ask for any of this to be this way or to go through it or anything.
Yeah.
She is the tragic hero.
Poor Lucy.
You know, I've never thought about that, but that is so gross. It's so telling. I mean, even nowadays, the way that men treat women that they either don't have a chance with or can't get anything out of, these women are treated like absolute dog shit because they're not seen as desirable or valuable for whatever the reason. And it's just so gross to me. They're human beings still. Like, this woman is literally dying and you guys just want to fuck her. Like, you're arguing over who's going to marry her still. Like, who is her actual fiance? That's what you're arguing about. It's just gross. It's just gross.
It's just indisputable that there are dark forces involved, you know, with Lucy's decline in health. And there are so many instances where at this point, Van Helsing's like, I know what the fuck is going on. I've seen this in a book before. And homeboy just starts breaking out the holy water. He gets the Christ crackers, the crucifix, the garlic, the Latin spell books. He brings out the whole nine yards. He's not going at this from a scientific standpoint, but he's coming at it from like a very occult witchcraft.
You can't tell me that Christianity is not still witchcraft. You can't look at like any of the rituals that go into any organized religion and be like, we against witchcraft. Homie, have you watched communion? It's witchcraft. Try again. You just drank the blood of Christ and ate a little cracker. No. Sit down. They need to have some reason to want to come over here.
Yeah. I mean, that's really the only way that Christianity is palatable, right? They were like, it's marketing, right? Well, we got to do some shit that the pagans like. They got to have some sort of outlet.
They'll do anything for a snack.
Yeah, we got to like worship some sort of idol. We got to give them snacks, like
charcuterie board and a bottle of wine. I too will do anything for that.
They'll do it. Like, it's fine. Like, yeah, it's all good.
That's a good time.
It's wine and crackers. I would do anything for that.
Well, ain't that the Christian way?
Yeah, well, when your options are, you know, we're going to appropriate your culture so that you worship the way we want you to worship so we can control you, or we'll just kill you and everyone you love and everyone you've ever known.
Mm-hmm. Who's got the psychology rant?
Me. And what is psychology or witchcraft if not spicy psychology anyway? So it still fits.
Talk to me.
All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to boop real quick over into some psychology on how Dracula and Freud go hand in hand and how Freud actually did some influence into the story of Dracula. Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
Good. I hope so, because I really don't care if you are or not. All right, so here's the deal. And if it sounds like I'm reading, it's because I might be a little bit. I spent time and effort basically writing a fucking thesis over here, and all of y'all are going to listen to it. God damn it.
Oh, Freud.
So Dracula was published in 1897, and Freud's discipline of psychoanalysis was postulated circa early 1890s. And I feel like we're all pretty familiar with Freudian concepts, but as a quick recap, Freud is an Austrian, was an Austrian neurologist who is most notably recognized for developing psychoanalytic theory, which is his theoretical model of personality organization and development. Psychoanalysis specifically is a set of theories and techniques that deal with the unconscious mind, and when used together, formed a method for treatment of assorted mental disorders. Psychoanalysis, however, largely disputed, super controversial discipline, and its effectiveness as a treatment has been wildly contested over the years. So although it kind of like retains some influences outside of the therapeutic arena. Like, we see it used a lot nowadays in like psychoanalytic literary criticism, as well as analysis of film. Shout out to what we're doing in this podcast. It's not used as like an actual therapeutic practice anymore, because TLDR, Freud is mostly a fucking quack. His theories and his sentiments align with the Victorian era of the time, but like modern scrutiny highlights the incredibly sexist nature of pretty much all of Freudian theory. All of his work pretty much blamed like mothers for the issues of their children and asserted that femininity was inferior to masculinity. That said, he did educate and support his daughter Anna, who went on to become a psychoanalyst herself, and she pushed back on the idea that hysteria was a female phenomena. And additionally, in his later work, Freud admitted that he actually didn't know shit about female sexuality and that most of what he said was wrong, as he should have. Yeah.
I just need to come.
Turns out we all just needed orgasms.
But, well, that was pretty much how we treated hysteria. But hysteria was originally stigmatized as far back as like ancient Egyptian times as an exclusively feminine malady. And it remained so pretty much until Sigmund Freud's way too fucking late and eventual self-analysis that covered his own male hysteria. Freud realized that his dreams and hysterical symptoms and even his laughter often released sexual expressions, which his Victorian society kind of severely repressed in a lot of ways. So how does this dumpster fire of a man tie in with Dracula? I'm sure you're all asking yourself. The Victorian author of Dracula, Bram Stoker, had some knowledge of these contemporary studies of Freud because, like I said, Freud's psychoanalysis theory came out a couple of years before Stoker wrote Dracula. And it's been rumored that this vampire fantasy revealed a lot of the Oedipal complex, which, again, was Freud's theory that everyone wants to fuck their mother.
Ew, no.
Blech. And that he had repressed a lot of these feelings since...
He had that theory because he wanted to fuck his mother.
Ugh.
Because Freud is a fucking quack. However, it's been rumored that the novel revealed the Oedipal complex that Stoker had been repressing since childhood, and that a lot of his sexual anxieties inevitably drove Stoker to an embarrassing fit of hysteria, which he then unconsciously like projected into a lot of the male characters of Dracula. So whether Stoker actually constructed his novel with sexuality as his primary focus, totally debatable. But the fate of those who exemplify like a lot of non-normative sexual behavior, such as like multiple partners or sexual promiscuity or female sexual agency, they all had like a pretty suitably severe punishment that Victorian people would have been in agreement with at the time. It seems to be a pretty common misconception though, right? That Victorians didn't really discuss sex. You know, we talked about it like Victorians were some kinky motherfuckers. And when we consider our Victorian predecessors, we think of them as like uptight and prude and frigid. However, if we take a look at some of the literature of the period, especially like Dracula and especially anything that concerns vampires, we start to see a society that's far more obsessed with sex than ostensibly let on. And every generation kind of creates their own like quote unquote vampire, right? It's a form of catharsis. And for the Victorians, this vampire functioned as a way to talk about sex without fear of public censor. And Freud keeps kind of like driving home this concept of the unconscious mind and the repressed mind at this time. And we see a lot of this represented in vampire work, because vampires work, you know, they operate at night and the count puts his victims into a trance-like state, and moral and sexual transgressions are relegated to the sphere of darkness and associated with these dark forces like we were talking about before. So it's kind of easy to see the novel as an examination of self, like sexual self-repression. And then there's been like a lot of rumors flying around the world since the time that the novel's been out about how this is got a lot of Freudian theory and it was Freudian influence. And there's a lot of homoerotic repression and sexual desire repression. And it's just kind of neat, mostly because I never remember Freud as being like a Victorian era scientist. I use scientist loosely. It's so bizarre to me that like Freud was at his height of career at the same time that this novel were released. And it's the same time that, you know, like vampire fantasies are coming about and vampires were used as a way to kind of talk about queer sexuality and repressed sexuality at the same time that we're kind of coming at the height of a lot of these other things. It's bananas to me. Again, Freud is bananas.
You know, it's really interesting to me too, when you were talking about how this was basically a way for Victorian era Bram Stoker to explore a lot of these ideas without fear of backlash or any kind of backhanded, you're not supposed to write about that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. and how Dracula, like the characters that undergo a lot of this like sexual awakening, sexual exploration, et cetera, they are under a trance or they're under magic or they're coerced against their will or whatever. And that really absolves them of the responsibility of going through what they went through, which I want to be very clear that I am not victim blaming in any capacity here. What I'm trying to get across is that I find it interesting that these are sexual explorations that the person who goes through it may enjoy. Asterisk. I mean, like, they may find themselves enjoying it for whatever the reason, and this is the only time that they would be able to explore something like that. And they can just say, I was coerced, or I was, you know, under a trance, or whatever, and I didn't like that, but totally did.
Yeah, which is what psychoanalytic theory was. Psychoanalytic theory as a practice is what you think of when you think of, you know, like, your very caricaturistic look at what a therapist is. You know, like, laying on the chaise lounge with your eyes shut, and the how do you feel? That's what's Freud kind of developed, was a lot of that, because it's going into this trance-like state and talking about, you know, what's coming up in your unconscious mind. It's almost like hypnosis-like. So all these characters, when they are under some sort of influence or manipulation or in some sort of trance, it's very psychoanalytical and very Freudian, because they're not in control of what's happening. It's very much their repressed or their subconscious mind, and it's not their fault what's going on.
Well, and I also want to draw a parallel to the Christianity aspect of this as well, because Christianity does the same thing in essence, right? Like, we are told, as long as we ask for forgiveness, it will be given to us. So that gives us this space, in theory, to make mistakes and kind to of. Explore and try things. And if we end up fucking up, we are given absolution at the end of that experience. And it's meant to be a freeing thing. And it's been bastardized into being a system of oppression.
Or you see the extreme end with Christianity, where it's, I was under the control of the devil, kind of thing. Like, I gave in to the devil's control of me. So, like, I asked for forgiveness, but it still wasn't my fault. It was the devil's fault. I didn't do it.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of power in putting yourself in a position where there are no repercussions, essentially. Like, you can give yourself permission to try new things because, you know, at the end of the day, it's just a video game. I can kill all the NPCs and I won't have any repercussions because it's just a video game. Like, that's the kind of vibe that we're getting here.
Yeah.
I can try this thing, or I can do this thing because...
Yeah. It's just my subconscious mind.
Right.
Do whatever I want in it. But it's just so crazy to me that, like, vampires were created. Like, they weren't just like, what's something that's fun and sexy? I know, vampires. Like, vampires as, like, a blood-sucking beast have been around for the dawn of time. But in terms of putting it into some, like, literary type of work of art and things like that, they have existed as some sort of scapegoat or some sort of representation of, like, marginalized people. And I just thought that was kind of interesting.
We love some vampire psychoanalysis. We do.
Thanks. I have a master's degree in everything. In vampires.
So cool. You did your research, babe. I love that.
I'm using it as your text tone for when you text me, you did your research, babe. And I love that. My praise kink is going crazy right now.
Oh, man. So, speaking of bloodshed, the gang decides to go after Dracula, right? So they're going to go back on his turf. Everybody has seen just how deep this wormhole has gone. You know, the downfall of Renfield, you know, Lucy getting just absolutely fucked up in a web of vampire bullshit and all of that mess, becoming a vampire, getting beheaded, you know, Mina having her emotions twisted to the point of deciding, yeah, I'll just be a vampire too. The list goes on. So Dracula leads them on an absolutely wild goose chase, two steps ahead of them in every way, you know, twists and turns, and they think he's going to be here and he goes there. And anyway, they finally get back to his creepy death mansion. Everyone is holding their breath and they finally are thinking, can we bring an end to this disaster? Hoping that Mina is the key and that she can finally get her shit together and snap out of her weird love spell. So that really kind of delves into this last theme, just revenge and redemption. And I think it's just really interesting how fucking entitled Dracula feels. He returns from the war, fighting this holy war for the church, and her soul's damned. He's damned now. He's pissed off. He goes into really, like, apeshit mode when he finds out that Mina is betrothed, and then that's when he really decides to fuck Lucy over.
You know, he does the same thing when Lucy decides to go over to the Orthodox church. She finds Jonathan, who has somehow, you know, wriggled his way free of the brides. They get married. It really brings it down to, like, does this motherfucker even deserve redemption? There are points, though, where you kind of feel bad for him.
No. There are points where I'm on his side. But ultimately, at the end, I'm on absolutely nobody's side but Lucy's.
Yeah, I have empathy, but like this motherfucker is clearly evil. And even Mina is like conflicted. You know, she realizes that she's like, oh shit, I love you. Whether she knows that she's his dead reincarnated wife or not, but she's like, damn, dude, you killed my bestie and murdered a bunch of people. And we get to the very end of the movie and, you know, there's all of this absolution and redemption arc. She comes to and fucking decides to stake him through the heart, kills this guy. And
it's more dicks. He finally got his
dick.
He got his dick finally.
Finally. And, you know, it's is it a happy ending? I mean, and it's just weird to
me. It's happy for nobody. Nobody's happy.
I guess Mina and Jonathan get to run off, but I just think it's weird that like she damned herself. She like she let his ass bite her because she broke the curse or whatever. She's absolved of being a vampire. How is that fair? Like, what about Lucy? What about all that other shit?
She forgot about Lucy. She said, time to run into the sunset with my Victorian dandy. Have a great day. Bye.
Lame. So lame.
Victorian dandies ruin everything. That's the moral of the story. It's not, but it should be.
What a wild ride. We have vampires. We have sexy queer shit. We have amazing costume choices. All of the things. So what this really goes to show you is how thin a line lies between absolute devotion and then the willingness to commit unspeakable deeds. So let's admit it. We've all been sips for people that we love. So I want to hear about some ridiculous shit that you guys let slide after super gluing those rose-tinted glasses to your face.
Truly.
It's okay. You're in a safe space, and we've all dated undercover demons before. So get to it. I want to hear about it.
Simps for the ones we love fucking sent me just then. That was so fucking funny. Because it's true. It's true. When you were in the thick of it, and then you're like, when you're on the other side, you're like, why didn't y'all tell me about this? And your friends are like, because if we had, you would have cut us off and never spoken to us ever again.
It's amazing what some like toxic dick will do.
Not even bad dick. Toxic. Ugh. I was proposed to without a ring. This was my second proposal. So I've been engaged twice. The one that almost stuck, the one that I ended up marrying, he proposed without a ring. And I ended up buying my own engagement ring and my own wedding band and his wedding band. And, you know, I kind of just let it slide because I was like, you know, he's just bad at planning things. And he didn't really want to, like, upset me with buying the wrong thing. And he knows I'm picky. So this works out because I got something that I actually would wear. But, you know, that if they wanted to, they would, is like in the forefront of my brain these days. Like if they wanted to put forth the effort, they absolutely would. And my current partner does that. Like my current partner treats me like gold.
Amen. She's the right one.
Good job, Colin. You can stay.
Yeah, good job, Colin.
Yay. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to call this guy a demon because he's not. We were 18 and very stupid. I actually had my first kiss when I was 18 and I became obsessed with this. It was literally the first week of college and I became obsessed with this guy. And he, when we kissed immediately after, he belted out, I kissed a girl and I liked it.
That is so good.
And then I was still so, and then he ghosted me because come to find out later, he came out.
Good for him.
And he's gay and he has done some incredible things. He's done some really, I mean, I've kept up with him on Facebook and stuff and it's great. No hard feelings, but I find it hilarious because it's like in a movie where you find something out and you're like, all of these like flashbacks come back and they're like all the puzzle pieces filling in. Like, the show tunes. Oh, that.
I feel like him belting that out was his way of like trying to,
yeah, he was trying to convince, yeah, himself,
sing his way into believing that.
Which honestly made it worse.
Poor 18-year-old Melissa.
Yeah, so I, you know, no hard feelings. It's a hilarious story. But 18-year-old Melissa was very, very sad.
I love that that's your first kiss
and
story.
She just needed a hug.
Poor baby.
Me too. So, aw, yeah. I'll give you a hug. Go hug James or Gilbo.
Aw.
Speaking of Gilbo and Basil, which are Melissa's cats, which I'm sure at this point you all know. So I'm not going to dig into my demon exes because we don't have time for psychology with Megan in that level today. So I will just say that my biggest red flag was that I dated a huge cat person that was like, which wouldn't be a red flag, except they like tried to force their love of cats on me. And I had to pretend that I liked their cats or they just like wouldn't let it go. Ugh. I don't like cats. I tolerate Melissa's cats because I love Melissa. But other than that, like, I'm just not a cat person, man. Like, and it's okay. Like, we can just differ on this. It's not a big deal. But she was adamant that, like, I had to fucking love cats. And I'm like, I don't.
Yeah. Just to clarify, like, his name. So we call him Gilbo, but I feel like I heard it as Dildo.
It's Dildo.
Not, it's not.
Melissa's cat's name is Dildo. Don't let her convince you otherwise.
You did nothing wrong, but I feel like I should clarify for the audience. It's short for Gilbert.
Dildo.
And we call him Gilbo because
I mean, it's short for Dilbert, and we call him Dildo.
It's short for Gilbo Cattens. So that is
his name. I knew you'd find a way to weasel Lord of the Rings into this episode.
Fuck yeah.
I feel like you guys have just like luckily not had to deal with.
No, I did. We just didn't dig into it.
Yes. Yeah. So I am going to put somebody on blast. I had an ex who was 1000% a conspiracy nut. Like, worships Alex Jones, was like preaching nonstop about the New World Order, like, loved to do this at parties. Oh,
I bet he loves Andrew Tate.
Like, absolutely nightmare of a human being. And truly convinced that he is a real life energy vampire. And, you know, I don't condone violence, but I definitely bitch slapped his ass when we broke up.
It's what he deserved.
Not my finest hour, but he did deserve it. And,
you know, sometimes people just need to be convinced
with the back of my fucking hand. And with that, I conclude this amazing episode.
Blair, what's up next?
Well, speaking of relationships that are toxic as fuck, Jesus Christ, Marissa.
I'm sorry.
Whoa.
I love the crazy. Well,
I'm glad you got out of that situation and now you're with Jeremy and we love that for you.
God, what a cookie.
Our next episode is going to be all about marrying the wrong person. That's right. We're talking about Tim Burton's Corpse Bride. I adored this movie when it first came out and I love it even more now that I spent almost 20 years. I can't believe this movie is almost 20 years old.
Yeah, I had to look that up when I saw that in the outline. I was like, this bitch can't type.
Can you believe?
Can, and you were correct.
Can you believe?
We're getting
old. Almost 20 years old. I'm sad about it, but it is what it is. I've been spending most of that time memorizing this movie. I have the sheet music to it. I fucking love it. It's amazing. There Will Be Bugs. You're welcome, Melissa. Yay. Unrequited Love, Murder, Mystery, Romance, and Intrigue. Seriously, what more could you want
in
a movie? Right?
Absolutely.
So perfect. And they wrap it up in like 90 minutes. It's short. It's beautiful. It's the claymation we know and love. It's going to be a great time.
But it's still super deep, so we'll have lots to say.
Knowing us.
So much to say. You know those kooky Victorians. We're going back to the Victorian times.
I love that. How on theme for us.
I know.
But this has been a blast.
Yeah, this was fun. The Clever Goals podcast is run by Megan, Marissa, Blair, and Melissa. The episode was organized and led by Marissa and edited by Blair. Our intro and outro music was created for us by Josh Marshall. Find his links in our show notes. For more episodes and other spooky content, find us on your favorite social media platform through our handle at Clever Ghouls. Don't forget to subscribe and share, and if you really like our content, please leave us a review. Lest we turn you into a blood-sucking vampire that can never indulge in garlic toast again. Thanks for listening.